So I've started recording, Eric, whenever you're ready.
Okay. With that, then, I will go ahead and I will call this August 18, 2020 meeting to order at 6:35.
For the record, I found an email from Commissioner Maddox saying he will be 10 minutes late.
Okay. We'll just go ahead and get rolling here, preliminary. Would everybody join me in the flag salute? I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, liberty and justice for all. Thank you. So for the time being, we'll note that Commissioner Huggins, Commissioner Freiberger, and Commissioner Frenette are present, and we'll acknowledge Commissioner Maddox once he does arrive. Commissioner Penno and Fatizzi have been excused. Has everybody had a chance to look at the minutes from July 21st meeting?
I have a correction to address.
Okay.
Page 2, where Catherine is reading the comments from Les and Susie Williams, I think she meant to write water runoff, and it just says water off.
Okay.
And oh, the other one is the last paragraph. It says PUD at homeowners. Should that be PRD?
Oh, yeah, I was kind of wondering about that. I wasn't present, so I can't comment on this substantively. John, are you?
PRD and PUD are used interchangeably in the industry. We use PRD. Some jurisdictions use PRD. Or we use PRD, some jurisdictions use PUD.
Okay.
So that one's not terribly substantive.
Okay.
Okay. It's just we used PRD earlier with Mr. Ruby's
comment. Yeah, we'll get it fixed though.
Okay.
Since we're doing grammar, there was a few that I saw on page 1. After Mr. Freiberger's, there's a space between the hyphen and the S. And then the last paragraph, 2.5, it should be acres and not acers. Yes, Commissioner Freiberger.
Just a minor correction, Mark Freiberger, the two times his first name is spelled with a C instead of a K, should be with a K.
Then the last one that I saw, which I don't know how important it is, but in the second public hearing, There is a close time, but there's no open time mentioned. And I wasn't there, so I don't know when that was. But I'm sure there's some record of it. That's all that I saw.
Oh, and one more that was confusing to me, the first paragraph in section 3. It says, the last sentence in the first paragraph, Mr. Fattisi read into the record an email from Doug Hartfield regarding the proposed single family homes be part of the adjacent Sauk Mountain HOA. I thought they wanted to make sure they weren't part of it, but to me, the way I read it, it sounds like they wanted to be part of it.
He was asking if they are going to be part of it.
Oh, okay. Got it.
Any other changes? Corrections?
I'm good.
All right, at this time, I'll entertain a motion then to accept the June 21st, 2020 minutes as amended.
I so move.
I second.
All right, it's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right, minutes accepted. And then either John or Catherine, was there any general comments that were submitted via email since no public comment is accepted with Zoom?
I have not received any. Have you, Catherine?
I have not, though we did receive comment after the last meeting, after the meeting had adjourned, but I believe that's addressed in the report. So
yeah, that's specific to one of the rezone requests, so that wasn't a general comment.
Okay. Yeah, no general comments.
Perfect. With that, we'll move along to the unfinished business, starting with rezone request number 2020-TAC-010, QAM request to change zoning designation of one roughly 2.5 acre parcel from industrial to residential 7.
All right, so I guess I'll take this one. So if the Planning Commission discussed this and I think was pretty well satisfied with the information presented. We left the public hearing open after the last meeting so we could make sure that everybody had the opportunity to comment. And we did not receive any additional public comments. So that's where we're at. Nothing new to report on that one. So if there's any more questions or discussion, feel free to do so today. Otherwise, if you have enough information, it would be okay to make a recommendation as to whether or not the council should adopt this rezone.
Okay. Also, just real quickly, I want to acknowledge that Commissioner Maddox has joined and is now present. So with that, I know that you guys had a pretty healthy discussion last month regarding this after the public hearing. Is there any further questions or concerns or comments that anybody wants to bring forward on this particular rezone request?
I'm good on Mr. Quam's property.
Okay. Thank you, Pat.
I'm good.
All right. Well, if there is no further comment, I will entertain a motion.
I could make the motion to recommend that the City Council approve amendments to the comprehensive plan and zoning maps proposed in RZ-2020-010 to change the zoning designation of assessor's parcel P76524 from industrial to residential 7.
Commissioner Huggins, I'll second that.
Okay. It's been moved by Commissioner Frenette and seconded by Commissioner Huggins to recommend that the City Council approve amendments to the comprehensive plan and zoning maps proposed in RZ-TAC-2020-010 to change the zoning designation of assessor's parcel P76524 from industrial to residential 7. All those in favor, say aye.
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 Opposed? All right. Motion carries. We're just ticking right along here. Moving on to the second rezone request, 2020-TAC-012, the Ruby property requests to change the zoning designation of roughly 3 acres of land from mixed commercial to residential 5. John, do you have any additional comments on this particular application?
So there were several public comments on this one last time, and the Planning Commission discussed it, had a few questions about the history of the property. So I was able to add some of the history to the staff memo. It starts around page 7 of the memo and the new discussion, talking about, there were comments about the water and the past use of the property and that there might be some possible conditions on the approval for this property. And so I looked through, I was able to, with a lot of work, first we had to figure out when it was annexed. So we had to figure out which annexation it was. And then we determined that this property was annexed in 1977. And then through just staff knowledge, mostly Nathan Salcina, who used to work at the golf course when he was in high school, I think. And so he knew the property owners and just knows the history of it. And he knew it was developed in 1972 by Al Fredland. So we were able to take that information and request from the county what we knew that it was developed in the county. So that was before our time. So we checked with them to see if there was any permits for that property. After a lot of back and forth, we're finally able to find it. Of course, it was misfiled, and it was somehow filed and recorded under like 1984, even though it was done in 1972. So we did find the original conditional use permit or special use permit for this property. That is attached to this memo, and as you can see, there's really not a whole lot there besides there's a request, and it's even just barely described as a conditional use permit to allow construction of a 9-hole golf course on the following property. It was filed with the testimony and exhibits in a open hearing August 12, 1971. And the board makes the following findings of fact. And basically you're saying it had a public hearing. It was posted properly for the notice of public hearing. The Board of Adjustment had a hearing on it on August 12, 1971. All interested parties present at the hearing were heard, and all testimony and matters pertaining to the application were heard and considered. Four or five Board of Adjustment members were there. Proposed use is located in a residential zoned area and is compatible with the adjacent property. One of their sixth finding is that the county is in need of a golf course. Actually in need of golf courses. And the proposed site is adequate in size and topography for a golf course. So number eight, the Board of Adjustments, having duly considered the matter, finds that a conditional use request would not adversely affect the public interest and would not be adverse to the public health, safety, and general welfare. And finally, the Board of Adjustment approves the request with the following conditions: that detailed parking and access plans be approved by the county engineer and county planning department prior to operation. So that was the extent of the special use permit approval conditions. That more or less answers the question of, you know, were there any special conditions on this on the golf course? Not so much in there. I was also able to get the aerial photographs from 1969, which is also attached. And that's a 1969 one right there on your screen. And you can see the barn is there by the red arrow, and the gas regulating station along Fruitdale Road is also there in 1969. You can see that there's a ditch going through the center of the property, presumably for drainage. It appears to be pasture land. There's no trees on the site. There may be water or signs of ponding, but it's hard to tell the extent of which. The National Wetland Inventory doesn't show any wetlands particularly on this property, at least not, and especially not that I can recall near the barn and in the 3-acre rezone area. There's also a photo from 1937 on the next page, and the gas regulator station is not there. The photo is not quite as high quality as the 1969 one, but you can see the barn is there, and the property appears to be used as pasture land at this time also. This one's so green it's hard to tell where that ditch is. It looks like it kind of runs right down the middle, right there between the word Cedrawilly and Puget, but I can't really tell for sure. And so the property's been used as pasture land for years, and possibly signs of moisture in a creek that's been ditched for quite some time. Not a lot of conclusive answers there for you. I apologize. But it is information, and I hope that helps in some way. We did receive an additional public comment on this one, and that is included also, I believe, hopefully, with the rest of the public comments on this. I believe I put them in chronological order, so it should be the last of the comments. Was received 7:22 via email from Matt and Lisa Howery. So hopefully everybody had a chance to read that. So that's the extent of the new information on this proposal. Just a reminder, you know, it's currently zoned mixed commercial, so the property owner could use it, could apply tomorrow for a, you know, a mini mart or a gas station, something that is compatible with the mixed commercial zoning. And we would, you know, have to review it and approve it as long as it can meet all of our city standards. So obviously we know that there's some water issues there, so we would have them do pay extra attention to the drainage concerns and soil analysis for a property like that, should they apply for a mixed commercial application. Now, if it were to be rezoned, it would go through the same process. They would still have to go through the development review and show how they're going to address the critical areas that are nearby and any flooding that might happen. So I know it's not what everybody wants to necessarily hear, but if it is zoning, you know, if it is mixed commercial, it can be developed. If it's rezoned to R5, then it could be developed. But they would have to address the same environmental and flooding concerns, regardless of the zoning. But that said, is it a good spot for residential? Is something that the Planning Commission definitely gets to have their choice of. So I'll leave it at that. And if there's any questions, I'm here to assist.
Hey, John.
Yeah.
Yeah. In the 1969 photo, it's very clear. You know, we talked in the past about where the creek was originally. And if you notice on the 69 photo that it runs right along the foot of hill there below the houses, and the ditch was picking up the water that was going over into the fields when it did flood. But you can see it very clearly, the creek running along the base of the hill there, just like it does to the west of the property.
So it's not running down to McGarrigle Road?
No, if you see when it gets even with the barn, about where the Portobello Bridge goes over it, or culvert goes over it, it turns to the left and runs right down the along the base of the hill there.
So what is that ditch that kind of runs down the middle of the property?
That was collecting all, I think that was collecting all of the water that that flooded over when it flooded each year. So I just thought that was, you know, interesting, because we had talked about where the creek originally ran, and that shows it pretty clearly.
Thank you, John, for looking into this even further. It sounds like you guys did a lot of digging on this.
And yeah, that's very much appreciated.
Yeah. I know that there was a lot of questions from everybody, and sound like you guys had a really in-depth conversation about this one in particular last month, and had a little bit of concern as to possible history that may have an impact on this. But I was amazed that you even came up with photos of the property from 1937. That was pretty impressive.
Those are just available on IMAP, the Skagit County IMAP. That's where I got those. Anybody can access those at any time.
So is there any additional questions or comments that people want to add, given this new information? Anybody want to add?
That answered my questions.
Okay. There are no additional questions or issues. I would entertain a motion to either accept or deny recommendation of this application to council.
So just to clear this up, John, the rest of the property is currently zoned R5, right? And so there's no, when the, I guess I'm just curious about how the process works. It's one part, is it just one parcel now? And then if they apply for a subdivision, they will have to go through all the environmental reviews and critical area and presumably some kind of CEPA review or something at that point. Is that the case?
Just like if it was developed as a commercial, right now it's mixed commercial. So if it were to be a commercial application, yeah, it would have to go through all the standard CEPA review. Well, depend, like, if it triggers CEPA, it's likely to. If it subdivision of more than 4 units triggers CEPA, and a commercial building over 4,000 square foot triggers CEPA. So it's possible that a commercial building could be built there without actually triggering CEPA. if it's, you know, less than 20 parking spaces and less than 4,000 square feet, then it wouldn't trigger CEPA, which is really just a review process. So people have more notification, and it casts a broader notification net than standard development application, which just goes out to everybody within 500 feet and is posted in the neighbor, posted on site, and sent to the newspaper. When the CEPA process is triggered, it also goes to several local and state jurisdictions to review.
So it seems to me that the public feedback has been universally opposed to this, but I don't see that the issues that they are concerned with are really relevant to this rezone. I'd like to hear feedback from other council members from staff about that, but it kind of seems to me like if we approve this, it's not really going against what it's separate. It's a separate issue from what the majority of the public feedback has been about, which is that the land shouldn't be developed, period. But it seems like the plan is to develop the land regardless of this zoning change. I mean, I don't know if this zoning change is a critical piece of that, but it seems like the goal would be to develop the land and maybe and just not do commercial in that spot. I would love to know if I'm, so I guess right now I'm inclined to go ahead and approve it, but with the understanding that there is, that this is separate from the larger issue of whether or not this property should be developed in the first place.
That's a really key statement. You know, whether or not the property should be developed in the first place is a little bit difficult for the Planning Commission to address because it already is designated as a zone that where development can happen. The real question is, I guess, you know, and there's lots of other issues here, but the big question is this property appropriate for residential or is it best suited for a small scale commercial to serve the local residential development? And, you know, you certainly can take into account, you know, is it more likely to, you know, what's going to have a greater impact on the neighborhood? Residential or commercial, you know, with the understanding that commercial hasn't developed in this. So, you know, commercial may not happen for some time. whereas residential would likely happen very shortly after the rezone would, you know, should a rezone be approved, it's likely that the applicant would then go forward with the larger PRD application for the entire golf course area. Just stating the facts.
No. So another question, and I was part of this process, but I have a short memory. What are, I know that the, you know, the petitioner stated that they wanted to apply for a PRD, and I have some vague memory of us allowing some limited commercial uses within a PRD application, maybe even in a residential zone. Am I correct in that, or is that
you're correct?
So if they're assuming we did do this rezone and they applied for a PRD, if they thought it was practical, they could allow for a commercial use on the property still, as long as it was in compliance sort of with that language in the PRD ordinance.
That is true. I can't say that that is the intent.
Sure.
I believe the intent would be, you know, residential use, and so if the community and the planning commission is concerned about losing the opportunity for commercial, then you know, that's one reason why you would want to keep it as mixed commercial.
So I'll go on the record and say I don't really think it matters. I mean, that we're losing that little bit of commercial land. It doesn't really seem like a viable commercial zone to me. And I mean, I would love to have a little shop there or something. I think that's a nice idea, but whether or not that's a commercially viable enterprise, I don't know. And I didn't take from any of the feedback from the public, which I feel like is very important, but I didn't gather that any of them necessarily were favoring a commercial use over a residential use for the property. It was more about restricting development as a whole there. And so I'm thinking I might be inclined to support this.
Commissioner Frenette?
Does the golf course, is the golf course dependent on that being commercial? Like if it's rezoned to residential, does that make the golf course go away automatically?
No, it would be an existing non-conforming, but it would definitely put pressure on the golf course to go away.
So that could be a death blow to the golf course rezoning. And second question is, does this rezone, does the development hinge on this? Like, is this an access point to the rest of it?
You know, even if it's zoned mixed commercial, they could still put a road through it to access the southern, you know, the residences around it. So no, not necessarily. If you left it as mixed commercial, then I believe you could still develop the rest of the area.
For some reason, I'm having a hard time with this one. For some reason, I think it ought to stay as it is, but I don't know all the facts.
Well, if there's more facts you'd like, that's what we're here for, to provide you more information. So if there's facts that are missing, I apologize. I'd like to get that to you.
Well, you did a really good job digging up a lot of information. That's great. I guess, Pat brought up a lot of good points last month that I thought it had something to do with the rest of that development. Sauk Mountain development depended on that open space or something like that. And I keep thinking about that. That's the part, the missing part that I don't understand.
It didn't depend on it, but he kept promising that it was a golf community and that people were moving there to golf and that they wouldn't need bigger backyards because they would be using the golf course. That would be their open space. So personally, I would vote against this because I know what it was like before they dug the ditches and drained it. And also because John Lang, when he was trying to sell the smaller lot sizes, said that that the golf course offsetted it as open space. And I would personally, I will probably vote against the change to residential 7, and also hope I can get somebody to go along with me to try and change it to open space so that it's not in compliance, but in the spirit of what John Lang was saying, smaller lots for Sauk Mountain Estates, so that because they would always have the golf course as offsetting open space. So in my mind, the golf course area should be open space, and I don't know if it qualifies as a critical area now. It would have if SEPA had been in place at the time they started, but I don't think the county was using SEPA yet in 72. Anyway, but I personally have been a vote against it. So I know too much history on it.
Commissioner Freiberger, any comments or questions?
No, it's a tough one. I can see the arguments both ways, but I'm inclined to think that this particular rezone that we're looking at is its own thing, as others have already said, and you know, the proper procedures will have to be followed for development later on. And if the golf course is something that is not something that is wanted, then I'm not sure how approving this or not approving it is going to necessarily change that. So sounds like development might happen either way. So
the State Environmental Policy Act was passed in 1971. So it seems unlikely that the county was doing any environmental review quite at that time, just because, you know, it takes a little time to get those processes in place. But I can't say for sure. I haven't come across any SEPA paperwork for this project, for the golf course.
Commissioner Maddox?
John, are we under any timeline on this?
No.
I'm just seeing that there's, we've got sort of a short attendance at this meeting, and it might be best to table the vote on this until we have a more full representation of the council to see if there's any other feedback on that. So,
I'm happy to get any additional information to you as well. Got my notebook here, and if there's anything you'd like.
And the chair would entertain a motion to table the issue if that's what the commission would like. I don't know whether or not it would be appropriate and or whether it would even be beneficial to do another public hearing on this and reach out to the greater community in that area to see their thoughts on this. I hear everybody from the commission that's spoken on this. I'm torn just as much as Joe is, and because I get what Silas is saying. You know, I get what Danielle is saying, and you know, I knew in the back of my mind that there was kind of something with the open space element of this and the development that went in there. And I think Pat, you know, being the great historian that he is, brought that kind of to light. And I was kind of wondering, and I thought that might be out there. So, I mean, it is kind of a difficult situation. And I think more thought would be appropriate, especially if we could get some additional commissioners to weigh in as well. What is the commission's opinion as far as proceeding with a motion to accept or reject, or perhaps tabling it and reviewing it?
Well, planning commission? Maybe I could bail you guys out. You know, the property owner, the applicant's not on the line today, so maybe we can make a special invite to him to make sure he's around for the vote. So if you're on the fence about voting tonight anyway, why don't we? That's one possibility.
I would personally love that if we could get the property owner to answer some questions about this, because I think it might clear up the issue for some people. And, it'd be good to get some more of the neighbors to be able to attend one of these things, because I think that they have some really valid concerns. I do sort of hold with my earlier opinion, but I think it might be good to have them in the room to understand how this decision is being made, regardless of the way that we vote, because they might very well be disappointed even if we don't approve this rezone, but the development moves ahead anyway. This is a fairly small chunk of a much greater parcel, and I can't imagine that they would not develop the rest of it regardless of how this rezone, or not, you know, strive to develop the rest of it regardless of how this rezone goes. And then just one more question, John, do we have like open rein as far as how we can rezone, you know, what our recommendation for a rezone would be for this? Or are we bound sort of by the city council's request here?
Well, it's not a city council's request. This was the owner of the property asked for a rezone change, or a change to the zoning. So are you implying that maybe you would change it to what are you getting at?
I don't know. I mean, Commissioner Huggins suggested open space. I think that may be, I don't know. The city might run into legal issues trying to do that to a piece of private property, but I don't know. I that's just a hypothetical at this point. But I, as far as our process here, we're not legislating anything. We're only making a recommendation to the city council. But it hadn't really occurred to me before he made that statement that maybe there was some other zoning designation that would be better applied to this piece of property.
I will look into that to see if the Planning Commission has the authority to recommend a different zoning than requested by the applicant.
Thank you, Saz. No, I fully agree with what he had to say about getting further input. I think that this decision, even though ours is just a recommendation, I think ultimately the council's decision on this will have a huge impact on this area. I think even greater than just like the surrounding 500 feet or what have you. So I wouldn't mind slow walking this a little bit before we actually make our recommendation, but I will entertain any motion that the commission would like to move.
I'm also happy to wait another meeting if we to get more input from and have more commissioners and the representative of the property available. That's fine with me too.
Agreed.
So I'll move to table this until the next meeting, pending further input from staff and the public.
Staff will schedule the next meeting to be a public hearing, so we can invite more public comment, so we can definitely post the site, put it in the paper. I don't know if we'll be sending to, I don't know if it makes sense to send another round of notices to everybody within 500 feet. I'll look into that.
Is it possible, John, to send email to these, to the specifically to the people who have submitted testimony to this point? Is it possible to just like send them an email notification of
Absolutely.
This? Just because I know I never, you know, unless I'm specifically seeking it out, I don't ever really get these
right. notices. And I'll see if we can do something like post it on the website. Not that anybody's looking at our website to, you know, see what kind of public hearing they can attend.
So just as a point of information, John, when it gets posted to the city website, does it also concurrently get posted to the city Facebook page? Because I'd imagine that would probably get a bit more traffic than the actual city site.
We've never done that. But we'll see if we can do that.
Okay, thank you. So I currently have...
Sorry, I'll second Silas's okay. motion.
Perfect. Thank you. I was just going
to
ask.
What was the motion again?
The motion was to table this matter until next month's meeting. And it sounds like we're all in agreement to make that a public hearing, have it on the agenda as a public hearing.
Yes.
And that date is September 15th. So careful, that sneaks up quick. It's an early one.
Okay. All right, so I have the motion from Commissioner Maddox and seconded by Commissioner Huggins to table this issue till September 15th meeting and to hold it as a public hearing. All those in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed, motion carries. That is the conclusion of unfinished business. Moving along to our public hearing. We're now moving to the proposed amendments to Title 17 of the Sejorville Municipal Code zoning to address parking requirements in the Central Business District. John, do you want to give us a quick intro before I open this up to the official public hearing?
All right, so since the last time we reviewed this, which would have been, I think, at least 2 months ago, the Planning Commission had requested that staff do an analysis of what parking looks like on various lots under the current zoning regulations and under the proposed zoning regulations that the Planning Commission had been kicking around and was wanted to see how that actually affected the properties. And the findings were, I don't know if they're surprising, but they're surprising. What we're seeing is, and Catherine can explain this in more detail, you know, the concern was with the current zoning is if a large project goes in, that there'll be a lot of, no parking requirements for a really large residential development or even a medium residential development. And so that would, you know, quickly cause a massive parking problem downtown. So the Planning Commission considered some lesser parking requirements for the CBD, but they were still pretty close to the regular parking requirements for the rest of the city. What we saw is, yes, when we look at a large parcel, if there was no parking requirements, there would be a need for a lot of parking. And I think Catherine showed that in her analysis. But what we didn't realize is when we put the parking requirements on, the draft parking requirements in, what it did was it made small parcels, especially ones like on Metcalf and Woodworth Street downtown, undevelopable. It's very concerning. So if there's any say there's no commercial component to the requirement for parking, but there is for residential. And so if you do a commercial building on the first floor and it doesn't need parking, but you do any residential upstairs and it does need parking, now you got to add 2, 3, 4, 5 up, 10, 15 units or two parking spaces. Those lots downtown are not very big. What we saw was, and I forget what page this is on, maybe Catherine can help us for the image of what page it's on. If you look at the building that burned down.
Page six. That's a lot, that's right. That theoretical lot is downtown.
This is a small lot that would be downtown, very similar to the one with the video store that burned down. You can see if you need to provide 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 parking spaces, there's no room for a building. So even if you just required, 4 parking spaces along the back, that really restricts this building. And 4 parking spaces doesn't really get you more than really 2 1-bedroom units. So it was a little shocking about what any parking restrictions on these smaller lots would do. But on the larger parcels, where you might need 100 parking spaces, where you might get 100 units, you definitely need some parking, because that would generate, over roughly 100 cars. So what Catherine did is she made some second draft recommendations. So now we've got the current development regulations, the draft ones that we came up with a couple of months ago, and now the third ones that Catherine put out there just as a starting point for a discussion of a 3-tiered parking system. So treating large lots, medium lots, and small lots differently in how they would have to allow parking. We staff admittedly did not spend a lot of time thinking through all of the potential ramifications of this, but we put it down for the public and the Planning Commission to review, and we're gonna let you guys figure out all the punch holes in our proposal. And we're not married to it. It's just a starting point. I think we're probably at a point now where we can have hold the public hearing portion of this, and then I can let Catherine talk more specific about the details.
Thank you, John. So at this point, I will open up the public hearing at 7:29 p.m. And was there any written comments that were either mailed or dropped off or emailed to the planning department regarding this?
I did not receive any email or mailed comments on this public hearing.
Okay, thank you. And scrolling through, I don't see any additional members of the general public, unless I'm missing something. So No additional members of the public are present. That being the case, I will go ahead and I will close public hearing at 7:30. And I'll go ahead and I'll let Catherine comment about this. This was pretty interesting, the packet that you put together. It was a bit eye-opening as far as the impact of the previous recommendations.
Yeah, so that was kind of the intent, to just examine a variety of lot sizes, both within and outside of the blue boundary, and how that the new parking code would affect those. And like John said, the original intent was to kind of address development on large lots that have no residential parking requirements associated with a commercial use, and how that would impact the city-owned parking downtown. And so, yeah, we studied four different lots, different sizes, and found that the small lots were disproportionately impacted. And medium lots, you know, it makes sense for them to absorb some of that parking for any residential use, but still have a reduced number. And so that's kind of why we came up with that three-tiered system. And like John said, it's kind of a jumping off point. When thinking of ways to get around that, or if a developer was gonna figure out a way to cram a lot of commercial and residential on one lot and not have to provide parking, I just thought that a lot size or per lot would make sense, since, you know, they couldn't subdivide it into a bunch of small lots and say, you know, we've met the requirements. So lot size. And then one thing I would really like some feedback on was the what defines the tier. So especially for commercial space, it gets tricky when you try to come up with a system for regulating the amount of commercial space and how, like, reducing that requirement. So we found a way to reduce the residential requirement in our last proposal or proposed code, but reducing commercial is a little trickier. So I went with a square footage approach. And that's open to comment and revisions. And that can be a little tricky too, because residential or commercial uses vary quite a bit, and so do their parking requirements. So for a restaurant, for example, and that's just something I addressed on page 6, was the requirement for a restaurant or an eating and drinking establishment is a lot more parking than, say, an office or a low-intensity sales store or something. So it's one space per every 75 square feet of open area or area open to the public. And so for a decent sized restaurant, that can be quite a bit of parking. And in the downtown area, where, you know, restaurants are kind of a desirable use, that's very limiting.
If I can break in just our procedural matter, I don't know that our minutes taker is on the line right now. I think she got dropped. What time did we open and close the public hearing?
We opened at 7:29 and closed at 7:30.
Thank you. That's all. Sorry to interrupt, Catherine.
No worries. That is important. So yeah, what I'm looking for here is feedback. What your thoughts are on the three-tiered approach and any ways we can improve that. You know, the intent is to make sure that we're still encouraging development in the CBD, and especially commercial developments, because that is, you know, the intent. So if you have any questions on the report, I'm happy to answer those. Otherwise, I would love some feedback.
So one really quick question that I have. So I did a rough count of parking spaces just on Metcalf within the blue line. And from where the south end to the north end of the blue line, I did a rough count of about 117 parking spaces. Is there really any lots within the blue area that could accommodate, you know, a parking capacity that even approaches 100? I mean, that seems like quite a bit of square footage and space to fit onto
right
your parcel. Well,
within the blue area, there's two city-owned parking lots. I don't know the count of how many parking spaces are in each of those. One of them is behind the Woolly Market,
mm-hmm.
and the other is across the street from the Styles office,
mm-hmm.
Otherwise known as behind the bank of the Wells Fargo Bank. Still Wells Fargo, right?
Up until the end of this month, I think.
So those are two parking lots that the city has provided to accommodate parking, to alleviate any parking problems that we have downtown, which have, I don't know, that's one thing that the Planning Commission hasn't really talked about is, you know, pre-COVID, what was the parking situation in the downtown city street?
Commissioner Maddox, you have a comment?
Well, I have a couple things, I guess. The first would be that the only place in downtown that seems to have an issue with parking, in my observation, which I live on Metcalf Street and I travel through the downtown core pretty regularly, is between Ferry Street and State Street on Metcalf. Otherwise, there's parking on every side street, the city lot. Sometimes the city lot behind the Woolly Market gets pretty filled up, but I never pay that close of attention to the one behind the Masons Hall. But it seems to me, just through my casual observation, that there's plenty of parking everywhere else. And so I don't think parking is a huge issue. And then my second comment would be, I actually kind of like a tiered parking requirement, at least for residential uses. But I would propose that maybe the tiering is based on number of units and not on lot size or building size. And so if somebody wants to put, say, 4 residential units above a commercial space, maybe there's no parking requirement for, you know, regardless of the lot size or whatever. Or maybe the, I don't know where the cutoff is, if it's 10. I know that I haven't fully comprehended all the details of this tiered system but it just was my first reaction that the cutoffs might be more relevant based on number of units as opposed to the size of the lot to begin with. And, you know, that gives developers some freedom to be creative, or maybe put in, you know, I don't know, I guess creativity is the thing that I like to leave open. So, but I do think there's plenty of parking for most sort of restaurant uses and office uses downtown if people are willing to walk a block or so. So that's my 2 cents at the end of this.
I think that's a great point. And looking at the tiered system, actually, I'm seeing it does sort of read like it's based off the number of units. So tier one is 2,000 square feet of residential / commercial space and up to 10 units associated with that use. And then tier three is up to 30 units, or tier two is up to 30 units, and tier three is 30 units and above, or above 30 units. So, you know, those numbers are a jumping off point, but that's kind of, I had a similar idea. I'm just allowing a developer to kind of get creative with where they place those units. But I thought it might be important to mention, you know, per lot, just as a way to potentially address any odd loopholes. And I'm hoping, as you know, having more eyes on this could spot any potential loopholes or ways that our intent could be missed.
I do want to make a quick comment. I would agree with Silas that probably the vast majority of the parking issue would be between Ferry and State. I drive through there a couple times every day, and I realize that my office and part of that public parking across the street from me is technically outside the blue area, at least a portion of it is. But I would say, given that I park there every day, it doesn't take a whole lot to really fill up that area. Even with Lemley's having their own kind of parking system, and then, you know, that unto itself can, if you get a fairly prominent member of the community that has a funeral, that fills up rather quickly, and so does the parking across the street. And it's not uncommon too to have any one of these where you have Lemley's, you have the Eagles, and you have the Masons. You know, at any given time, I've experienced where a couple of them or all three of them have all had events at the exact same time, which can cause quite a bit of congestion. And then you just throw in local businesses like Styles or Wells Fargo and their regular customers. And so there can be situations, I think, in a day-to-day, no. Ferry and State is probably the most of the congestion, but it can change rather quickly. So I'll just want to throw that out there. Any other questions or comments, observations? Pat, I can't see you, so I'm just gonna single you out here.
I'm not sure why I can't be seen. I can't find a setting on my computer to join visually, even though I'm on a computer where I usually do. I agree with Silas's analysis, and you're right, it can change periodically, Eric. It's been pretty good analysis of what's going on there. I also am still digesting the three tiers of the thing.
Yeah, it is quite a bit to digest. I think it's a very good launching point. Planning Commission is both to be commended and probably condemned for how hard we've been working on all these various projects that City Council has finally thrown us a situation where we're trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. I know parking has been a issue in downtown since time immemorial, it seems like. I definitely don't expect us at all to be moving forward too terribly much out of this meeting. But if anybody has any, like at least initial observations, I think it'd be good for staff moving forward to the next meeting.
I think Silas's comment is probably a good one to explore. It treats the parcels fairly. If we have a three-tiered system, my one concern about that was, and I haven't had a lot of time to digest this either, so we just kind of got it out there and got it to you, and haven't had a lot of chance to think it over too much. But the one thing that stuck in my mind that I was a little bit unsure about is, seemed to be a system that might treat parcel owners different. If you have a bigger parcel, you have to provide more parking than someone with a small parcel. Is that a problem? I don't know. It's a legality we'd have to look into. But that was the one thing. And if we do something that just says, you know, if you provide, if you're creating so many units, then you have to provide this, you have to provide parking. That seems like a good way. So maybe exempt a certain amount of units to start with. And then of course we'll have to have a caveat say, well, you can't take a large parcel, subdivide it into 16 lots, and then expect to, you know, to still take advantage of that exemption for the first few units on every one of those lots. That's not fair.
Mm-hmm. It may fall under takings, John. I mean, for the bigger developer who has a bigger lot, he's not going to lose total use of his land to meet the parking requirement, whereas the smaller developer basically loses the right to develop his property. So it might fall under that. I don't know. Just throwing it out there.
Probably not, because you know you can always provide parking underground. It just costs more. I don't think we're in any takings territory, but it's always good to keep in mind.
I would like to bring some attention, if I can, to the additional amendments proposed for 17.36.020 with the blue boundary. So in the first draft, there's a specification that existing buildings within the blue boundary were exempt from the parking requirements for commercial uses. And then when that was applied, we found as well downtown that does limit those smaller lots. If they're just doing a commercial use or just a restaurant, it would still be a challenge to provide parking on those lots. So we added new buildings that contain commercial space or residential space associated with commercial space shall provide parking in accordance with the tiered parking requirements. So I just was wondering if there was any thoughts about that blue boundary issue, if we wanted to re-examine that.
The history on it just was that within the blue boundary, you know, everything was built out. And at the time, there was only one unit allowed above each commercial building. And so parking wasn't an issue, but we were hoping that we could start to make a walkable 24-hour community, which means we wanted people living downtown. So we were trying to get them to renovate the upper floors of those commercial buildings and put in units. And when we started looking at the things they would be up against, for example, having to put in elevators and sprinkler systems and then parking besides, it just was obvious that nothing was going to happen, even if we allowed it. So anyway, that's kind of some background on it. That's why in that area we said if the building already existed, whether it had residential or not, they didn't have to provide any parking. And we figured that new development would take care of itself as it came along. So we kind of always knew this day was going to come, but it doesn't make it any easier.
Pat, if I could just ask you for, out of curiosity's sake, just because it stands out so much to me, being someone who works daily in a building just south of the blue line, what was the rationale for the alleyway versus just going a little bit further and using Warner as the southern boundary of the blue line? Do you know? Do you remember?
Yeah, so I probably proposed that. The idea behind that was simply that on Warner Street, you had houses facing Warner and you had businesses facing State. And we didn't want to get in a situation where we had, you know, people showing up saying you're zoning my house commercial, it's going to get torn down and a business put there. And so at the time, major growth was not an issue. And these things are always a work in progress, you know, all the zoning, all of the comp plan stuff is always a work in progress. And so we said, let's just take the easy way out here and we'll just run the line down the alley and keep the existing uses in the areas. And places where we didn't do that was like over on, I think Reed Street, I think we go, I don't know about the blue area, but the CBD goes clear over like to Reed or something like that. And And that was because there were people in that area requesting that they be able to turn their houses, like you see in a lot of small communities, they want to be able to turn their houses into businesses. And that's been very successful in a lot of places that I've been to. That's why in certain areas, we incorporated areas with houses already built, residential already built. And in other places, we just kind of went down the alley and kept the existing uses in the zones that they were in already.
The idea was to keep it around commercial areas. And half of that area along Warner is residential. So that's, but you know, on the street just north, which is State Street, is all commercial. So we wanted to include the commercial on State, but not the residential that's facing Warner.
Okay, thank you.
Now that does leave out your building, your work building, I think. We could have jogged it another half block south, but we're trying to keep kind of straight lines.
Well, I mean, it's not just my building. I mean, it's also Anytime Fitness. And then there's that vacant lot right across the street from there, which I could see being developed. And I know the owner of that property, and he's one that could very well decide to develop it or sell it to somebody that would develop it. So that's part of my rationale. It wasn't just,
well, we could redraw the blue line. I mean,
yeah. I was just going to say, you could bring it up at, next time we're doing boundary zoning land use, we could do that. So
no, we could do the blue line as part of this, because the blue line is part of this chapter.
Yeah,
and it has very, it's strictly a parking related thing. It's not zoning. So we could redraw the blue line if we want. I think it may have also been based on the landscaping exempt area. So areas within that, in the landscaping chapter, there's a similar description of an area within which it doesn't make sense to have landscaping requirements, because it's all, you know, old downtown type development. So we didn't want to require 20% landscaping in a new building on Metcalf Street that would not fit in the area. So I think this, I drew the blue line and with the Planning Commission's, you know, discussion. And I'm trying to remember why exactly we chose it. I do know that we're trying to have commercial, and I do know that I loosely based it on that landscaping line. So we could change it, is the point.
I mean, I totally get what you guys are saying as far as especially that easterly half of Warner. If you were to drop it down to Warner, I mean, that's, I guess there's at least a couple houses there. I know that dentist office that's on the corner of 4th and Warner, I mean, that's a fairly sizable lot that, I don't know that owner, but I could easily see that property being developed into something other than residential.
But in that area, we would want them to provide parking because they're in the middle of a residential feeling area.
And that lot is pretty sizable to where they could provide parking too anyways. I mean, probably the thing that stands out to me the most for Warner is that corner lot on 3rd, it'd be 3rd and Warner, the eastern corner. I mean, I just have a, I honestly don't know. I'm not saying like I, even though I know the property owner, he's never said anything to me about it. But I just have like a gut feeling that that could very well be a commercial residential building. And I don't know if it makes sense to dip that blue line down, you know, up until just east of that parcel and then shoot it back up to the alleyway, if that even makes sense or is even worth our while.
And just to clarify, when you asked the question about the blue line, I thought you were talking about the CBD line, Eric. So my comment was about the CBD line, not about the blue line. I wasn't trying to steal John's John's work there. I thought you were talking about the how we ran the CBD line down the alleyways.
Oh, Pat, you were part of that blue line designation process. So I thought you knew what you were talking about. Seemed right. So we can,
Commissioner Freiberger?
So I guess something I was thinking about looking at the three tiers is, and something we can fine tune, it's just making it understandable, because obviously when I first looked at it, I was kind of going, wow, that's kind of a lot to take in. And then for somebody, obviously the planning department will be there to interpret this for property owners, but I think, was it Commissioner Maddox who was saying something about just doing it based on units rather than lot size that might help simplify it a little bit? I don't know, that's a thought, but that was kind of instantly what I thought about when I was looking at it is, wow, am I comprehending this correctly? And every time I look at it again, I understand it a little bit better, but it really, there is a lot in there. So, and the fact that it's in two different spots too, with the, you know, the area within the blue and then outside, you know, and you know, we have 1724.50 and then also the, again, you know, it's just, it's just a lot. So I suppose we can only make it so simple, because if we don't over specify, then there's going to be confusion, but I don't know. Just would like to make it as clear as we possibly can for lay people as well.
It's a very good point. Thank you, Daniel.
Yeah, making it pretty clear. There was a challenge there, because I'm reading this as well, like as I was writing it, I was like, how do I make this not so complicated while addressing the issue with the disparity between the small lots and the larger lots? So I'm open to all kinds of suggestions for a simpler method.
Well, why don't we all think about it some more and see what we get next time.
So I guess just to follow up on Catherine's statement, it seems to me like the easiest tiering system would be based on number of residential units and commercial square footage, which reading back over this, it looks like it's kind of already there in the tiered system, and just remove the lot size equation. And I don't know where those tiers, I don't have a comment specifically about where those tiers should be. And then I do think that it might be worthwhile revisiting the blue line, just to see if there are additional developable lots in the downtown core that maybe fall just outside of it that, you know, I don't know if it's worth it or not. I wasn't around for the blue line drawing, so. And then my other comment was, I don't see the commercial parking requirements in this. And am I just missing them, or are they somewhere else?
Those are somewhere else. They're pretty detailed, and they're dependent on the use. So in my analysis section, I included certain uses in their requirements, like a restaurant being one space per 75 square foot of space open to the public, an office space, which is 300 or one space per every 300 square feet of gross space. And I think there's also one for low intensity sales, which is 400 or one space per 400 square feet of space open to the public. But I have to double check
that. That's all in a different chapter. That's in our off-street parking chapter, which is 1736. And that's what the blue line says, is like, don't worry about 1736 if you're doing retail or commercial in the downtown, because we really want to encourage that.
Sure. So let me just, for my own clarification, how do you determine parking requirements for a new building if the use is not designated at the time of permitting or whatever? I mean, if a developer is just building sort of generic commercial space that could have a variety of different uses, how is a parking number determined for that?
It's a hassle.
No, that's a great question.
So what we do is we start with the bare minimum. We start with a lower one, and we have to work with the developer to say, you know, if you develop a restaurant in there, you're going to need more parking. But what we've seen outside of the CBD, most buildings are built with a specific purpose. So it hasn't been an issue, but it is a concern. When a building's built not to suit and they don't know what's going to go in there, it's problematic.
Yeah, going off that, we actually have a pre-application meeting tomorrow for someone that wants to build in the CBD outside of the blue line, and they want to build two different commercial spaces for open-ended commercial uses. And it's kind of complicated, like, well, what do you need to provide? Because they're required to provide parking for those uses being outside the blue boundary. So it makes it a little tricky when looking at those kinds of developments and applications.
Commissioner Burnett, been a little quiet. Do you have any thoughts or comments that you want to pontificate about?
On that last topic, you know, good one, Commissioner Maddox, for bringing that up. What if it's generic? What do you do? And John, you said require the minimum amount of parking spaces. Maybe you could fix it all by requiring the maximum amount of parking spaces if they can't figure out what they want. But I got another question. Did the city council say we must come up with a plan, or they said we suggest you come up with a parking plan?
All they said is they wanted you to look at it.
Because I'm still kind of leaning towards the developers are gonna do what they think is best. I know that we're trying to prevent somebody from taking advantage of other people's parking spaces, but I think if I'm going to spend all that money, I'm going to make sure there's parking for people that want to be there. So that's how I'm leaning. Plus, I'm kind of an outsider. You guys are all spending lots of time in downtown, and I'm still way out here in the country. So I don't witness what you see every day. But I'll go drive around there for the next month and get a good feel for it.
Now is probably not the best time with a lot of businesses doing limited service and others closed.
Well, a great time to see it still fairly busy is on Wednesdays with Farmers Market. Of course, that's more a little bit north, I guess, of some of that, but definitely can be interesting. Yeah, you can find parking, just not on Metcalf necessarily. Yeah. not up by the farmer's market, at least.
Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Go ahead, Joe.
Oh, I was just saying that's a good sign if there's no parking and it's busy then, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's always been a point, is that that's a good problem to have.
Yeah.
Especially considering the desire for increased business in downtown. Good. And Commissioner Huggins, you had a comment you wanted to add?
Well, kind of a question and a comment. So it seems to me that that we're kind of trying to figure out what the threshold is for creating, for development size, creating a problem for parking. And we've kind of, I think we've all kind of come to the conclusion that the existing buildings and small scale developments on these, on the small lots by themselves probably isn't a problem, that it, you know, can be handled by the lots that we have, the municipal lots, and maybe parking on the side streets a little more than what we are now. But we need something to protect us in case somebody comes in and just buys a block of downtown Cedar Woolley and says, we're going to put up a, you know, a five-story thing with commercial on the bottom and apartments above. And so it seems to me that that's the thing that we need to try to solve. And for those bigger developments, you know, I think we have the in lieu, I mean, we could have the in lieu process where they buy parking elsewhere nearby, which I don't know exactly how that, that works, but something like that, or they develop it on site, either underground or above, or however they want to do it, but they integrate it in. And then that kind of just tables the small stuff, you know, the one or two units that are nondescript, they don't know what they're going to be yet. I don't know. That's just my thought process right at the moment is, it's not the little things that are going to get built that are they're more of a death by a thousand paper cuts instead of just having a meteorite hit you or something. So that's just my thoughts to where we are now, is that we need to be working on what to do when the big developer comes in and wants to do something big, not so much about what to do with existing buildings or small projects that are coming in, where we kind of know it's covered with the, existing parking. Just my thoughts.
One kind of last question that I have for either John or Catherine. The Gateway building on Ferry and Metcalf. So I know that, that that's an existing building, and so I realize that it probably doesn't necessarily apply to this, but at the same time, the majority of that building is pretty much unfinished and not done. And I know that there had been plans to have it be possibly residential. So how would you categorize that, where you kind of have like this unfinished building that could potentially have a significant amount of units in it and doesn't have any sort of parking requirement that's attached to it, nor does it have really a whole lot of options as far as creating additional parking? I mean, it seems like if that was to get bought and it was to get developed into condos or apartments or what have you, that the vast majority of that would just be right there on Wall Street parking.
So go ahead.
Actually, that's addressed in 1724.050. There shall be no off-street parking requirement for residential dwellings in association with the commercial or retail use in the central business district. So there's just no residential requirement. There's currently no requirement for parking for, you know, those top two or three stories if they were to be redeveloped as residential. And they used to be residential. Mm-hmm. You know that there's a parking lot just north of that Gateway building, but that's not part of their property. So right. They really don't have much parking. They just have a few spaces along the building on the north side and then a few spaces along on the east side.
Did they never own parking there? Because I thought back in the day that it had, when the Gateway Cafe was there, I thought that was all their parking. They used to have big tour buses parked in there and for Skagit tours. And
somebody else owns that parking lot. And, you know, you've probably heard about that property owner having people ticketed and towed during the farmer's market. So the property owner doesn't want people parking there. They want to sell the parking lot to people who need it. So they're withholding their parking lot from use to convince somebody to buy it.
Good to know.
So the answer is our code now intentionally, as Pat was saying earlier, intentionally exempts the residential in existing buildings so that they don't have to magically come up with parking if they were to redevelop the upstairs of one of those downtown buildings that hasn't been used as residential, but would be a really good use if somebody were to, you know, spruce it up and make them living spaces again.
Commissioner Maddox?
So just to be clear, that exemption would not change under the new proposed rules, that these new proposed rules are only for new development or new construction. Is that what I'm hearing you saying? Or would then something like Gateway, if assuming we passed some sort of new framework for parking, would it then be subject to that?
It would be whatever you want.
But in the tiered approach, that building would not be required to provide parking for the residential or commercial uses, being inside the blue boundary.
Because of the number of units or because of its historic or pre-existing status?
A little bit of both. It's pre-existing status inside that area described in 1736020.
So that, as written, or you know, hypothetically right now, assuming we do, or you know, if we implement some new parking requirements, the pre-existing conditions will still be exempt from those parking conditions. Is that what I understand?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we'll make sure that whatever we write keeps the ability for the existing buildings to not have to provide parking for new residential.
It seems unlikely they could put more than 10 units in the upstairs of that Gateway building, but I've never actually been up there, so I don't know.
Oh, exactly. They could get a lot more than that. I think it's 3 stories and it's a pretty big space. It might be 10 units per floor or more.
Yeah, it's pretty sizable.
And the not making the businesses within the blue line would change if somebody bought a block of them and redeveloped it from scratch. Then they would have to provide the parking.
So
how do you want us to do it?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point, Pat, because under the first draft original code or proposed code, yes, if they were to tear that down and build a new building, they would have to provide parking. But under the recently proposed code changes, they would not have to require any parking for commercial or residential uses in that area.
Okay, thanks, regardless, Catherine.
Yeah,
thanks, Catherine.
Thanks.
Any other comments or questions? All right. So do you have at least enough for us? I mean, I realize it's all still clear as mud to a degree.
Yeah. I guess my question, going off our last conversation, I mean, this most recent bit about that Gateway building, is how do you all feel about the most recent proposal where they would be exempt that building from requiring parking for commercial or retail, regardless of whether it was a new building or an existing building?
I think if they actually built out apartments on all three or on the upper floors, that they would have to provide some parking. I thought they owned that back parking lot. I thought it was all one property. I never knew that it was two separate, because it was always used by the um, by the hotel and the Gateway Cafe as their parking. So I don't know. I didn't know if they've sold it later or if they never owned it and they were just leasing it from the guy that owned it. But anyway, so that's something I got to think about a little bit because I just assumed they owned it.
Don't get too concerned about specific lots. Think of the broader. I mean, I can tell you the details. The owner, when they sold the building, but they pulled, from what I understand, they pulled a fast one and didn't sell the parking lot with it. But I don't know if that's true. That's the lore. But it's going to be really difficult if we tell that the owner of the Gateway building that they need to provide parking for all the new residential above, that project will never happen.
Because yeah, he's going to be upset if he thinks he now has to buy the property that he thought he already bought. anyway, I'm starting to get a closer idea in my mind of, you know, if you've got two units or three units above one of our existing buildings downtown, I'm not really concerned about parking. But if you suddenly put 10 on each floor of a building somewhere in there, you need to have some parking provided. So now I'm thinking in my head that I can't remember your exact numbers, Catherine, but we definitely at some point have to step in there around 10 or 8 or something and say, yeah, now you got to provide some parking for that. So
yeah, well, and 10 was the number.
I don't normally like to push an issue, but as far as, you know, if making existing buildings provide parking, it's kind of a non-starter because the property owner won't be able to. Their only option is to buy a parking lot nearby at, you know, they'll be getting they won't be getting a good rate because people say, well, we know you need this, so we're going to hold you at gunpoint. So, you know, if we want to see the buildings redevelop, I really think we got to be careful about putting any sort of parking requirement on the existing buildings.
Yeah, and, you know, I totally get that. And, you know, as far as crafting policy goes, I would definitely strongly support that you know, any existing buildings be exempt in that blue lined area. The only reason I brought up the Gateway building was it's kind of a unique one for that area, that specific area, and I could just see where, given its potential, you know, it could throw a wrench in that curve. But you know, it's one building versus all the other buildings, existing buildings, you know, that's a non-starter. So that's the only reason I would bring that building up. Otherwise, you know, I would fully support exempting all current existing buildings within the blue line.
I agree with that. I think that the exemption for pre-existing buildings should remain because we need to do we need to create every opportunity for our historic buildings in the downtown core to be renovated and revitalized. And I think eliminating the parking requirement goes a long ways towards, I mean, or is at least one step in that direction. So that's my view on it.
So the way it reads now, with the most recent proposed code changes, is more or less exactly that. So existing buildings are exempt and new buildings would have to follow the tiered system. Is that good?
Yep.
All right.
Is there any other initial guidance that you were looking for us off of this. I do think it probably would, it is going to behoove us to digest this just a little bit more, and I'm sure we'll come back next month both with a little bit more clarity from you guys as off of this, and then just off of our own thought process.
Yeah, and I appreciate your feedback. I realize we threw like a 20-page report at you with a lot of details. So yeah, I didn't expect you to come to like conclusions at this point. So we can all think about this more and talk about it in next meeting.
Sounds good.
And thank you, Catherine. This was great work. A great long point. Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
All right. So there's no other comments. I will move along to, is there any discussion items that anybody wants to throw out? Anything good for the good of the order? Yes, John.
So I mentioned in the email when I sent this out that we were scheduled to have a September 2nd joint City Council Planning Commission meeting. That was changed because the council needs to address budget at that September meeting. So they're going to have a big budget work session. So they've rescheduled the Joint Planning Commission City Council meeting for October 7th. So keep that in mind. And the other big news is the city council passed the ADU ordinance back in March, but then COVID hit and they weren't able to finish up the fee discussion. So we've spent the past 2 months or so discussing the ADU fees, and they finally came to terms with what the fees should be. They chose a reduced fee schedule for ADUs. So it's roughly 60% of, the only fees that, the only impact fees they'll charge are fire impact fees, or just based on square footage of new buildings. So that's, and those are minor. Then traffic impact fees are 60% of a normal connection fee for a larger ADU. And then for smaller ADUs, which are 400 square feet or smaller, I only pay 30% of what a normal traffic impact fee will be. So I forget the numbers. The current traffic impact fee for a single family house is $2,400. So 60% of that, I think it was $1,500, and then like $800 and something for a small ADU. We chose a similar tiered system for the sewer connection fee, which currently is $8,000. So 60% of 8,000 is, math, less than 8,000. And then a small ADU, which again is under four, maybe it's 450 square feet down to 200 square feet, is 30% of a normal connection fee. And then a park impact fees, which are $1,500, is again 60% and 30%. So we did pass reduced fees for ADUs. And those go into effect next Monday, the 24th, I believe. I'm looking at my calendar. If you see me looking off oddly from camera, that's why. But either, yeah, I think the 24th they go into effect. So we're getting our applications in order in anticipation that at least a few people are interested in doing that.
Thank you.
That's all we have.
All right. Any other discussion items? If not.
Not discussion. Just want to thank you, John, and you, Catherine, for all the work you did. You guys always work a lot for us, but putting this tiered plan together, Catherine and John, all the research on the golf course out there, that's a lot of work, and I really appreciate that because it answered a lot of questions for me. So thank you again.
Yes, thank you. With that, I will entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved and seconded.
We moved and seconded to adjourn. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. We are adjourned at 8:25.
Thank you, everybody.
All right. See you guys.
See you later.
Thank you, guys.